As presented by Andes Manta of Ecuador and the jazzy hip-hop sounds of the Cincinnati-based trio Is What. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with a writer. His name is Edward Falco. He has written novels and short stories and also poetry, and he is a teacher as well. He teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at Virginia Tech. He makes his home in Blacksburg, Virginia. He also edits The New River. It's an online journal of digital writing. His most recent books are Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha, New and Selected Stories, published by Unbridled Books, a novel that we'll talk about here this morning, a novel titled Wolf Point, also from Unbridled, and In the Park of Culture. That's a collection of short fictions from the University of Notre Dame Press. That also just came out this year. And he's authored a number of other things, collections of stories and also poetry. He's won a number of awards for his work. His stories have also been published widely in journals, including the Atlantic Monthly, Playboy, Tri-Quarterly, also collected in the Best American Short Stories, the Pushcart Prize, and a number of other anthologies. He's here spending a little time on the campus of the University of Illinois, his visit sponsored by the MFA Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. From time to time throughout the school year, the department brings in writers, poets, so that students here can have the opportunity to talk with them about their work and about the craft of writing, and that is what brought him here. We're pleased that he could spend a little time with us this morning talking about writing, and questions are welcome, too. If during the course of the conversation folks who are listening want to get involved, you can do that. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to talk a bit about Wolf Point, and I promise we'll not give away too much. I don't want to. Whenever we talk with people, and I talk with people, and I do occasionally, who have written fiction, I always feel there's this difficult line trying to walk between actually saying something about the work and not saying so much that people who are listening would say, well, I guess I don't need to read that. So
right.
we'll try not to do that.
Thank you.
This is a story that has just three characters. And what you do is you put them together very early in the story and then put them in an isolated spot. And the action takes place among the three over a very short period of time. And although the three characters are alone together, the three of them, they clearly have brought a lot of baggage with them because everything that has happened to them up to that point is very important in the interaction that happens between the characters. Is it something that you're just particularly interested in that you wanted to focus in so closely on this very small group, put them in this very isolated situation, and then just see what would happen?
It's generally the way I work as a writer. I like to create a situation that's dramatic with characters I care about and then see what happens. In this particular story, I had the principal character, T, was somebody that somebody that I cared about and who had a difficult and sort of complicated past. Mm-hmm. And I put him in a car and he picked up two hitchhikers, and then the story just sort of took off from there.
Yeah. That's when if you've read enough stories and seen enough movies, you know that picking up hitchhikers is a bad thing.
Exactly.
Right from the very beginning. So this is one of those stories when it begins, you think, no, this cannot be good. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the book is that there is a tension and an undertone, a really sort of dark undertone that starts right at the beginning and is maintained fairly well throughout the telling of the story until its resolution. And you think right from the beginning something bad is going to happen here, and eventually something does, but it takes some time for that to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, these characters are, as he sees them, it looks like he calls it a pulp tableau. There's a very sexy looking, very young woman on the side of the road, and along with her is a guy, tough looking guy, and he's carrying a guitar case, and she's out there hitchhiking. It just, you know, only a fool would stop for such a thing. And the question that the reader has to ask is, you know, why would an obviously fairly intelligent man stop to pick up two hitchhikers that look like this? And I think that's the question that propels a lot of the novel. Why does he stop? He says, I knew better than to stop, and that's exactly why I did. And I think one of the questions we ask as readers is, what's going on with the psychology of this guy? Why would he stop to pick them up? Why would he, once he knows that they're dangerous, why would he stay with them? Why wouldn't he leave? Those are all central questions to the development of the real point of the novel.
Yeah. And that, in fact, there is even a point where once they reach the place that they're going, there's a point where he could leave. He could just get in his car and he could go. And again, he doesn't.
Right. The reviewer in the Times actually asked that question. He says the story could be short-circuited at any point by him walking away. Mm-hmm. And we have to ask ourselves why he doesn't. And then the reviewer goes on to propose his own ideas about why he doesn't simply walk away.
Mm-hmm. The character here, that the main character is Tom,
right.
The man who we start out with. He's driving along, and among the things that we learn about him in the course of the story is that he's someone who, in his professional life, in his business life, has been successful if making money is your indication of success.
Right.
But the rest of his life is a mess. It's out of joint. He is living alone. And he clearly is at a point where he's trying to figure out what went wrong. That seems that's part of what's going on, or trying to achieve some kind of understanding about himself that he didn't have.
Yeah, I think he's clearly a depressed character. I mean, I'm doing my own analysis of the book when we sort of get into this stage of talking about why he picks them up. Yeah. I don't think I really understood in writing the novel what was going on emotionally and psychologically with T, which was why it was a pleasure to write. Things started happening in the book that were interesting to me, and I myself was asking why would he stop to pick up these hitchhikers, why would he do these things, and the novel was really a kind of exploration of his character and of his psychology. I don't think it gives away too much to say that his life has been disrupted in part because he downloaded a pornographic image from a website. And he says he did it out of interest in the image. What the things that he saw were somehow resonant and interesting to him. And he claims, I was just looking. I did nothing wrong. All I did was look at a picture. However, if you read the novel, you learn that that had tremendous implications that wound up pretty much destroying the life that he had been following for a long time. Mm. So when he picks up this hitchhiker, who's also a very young woman, there are connections between the way his life has gone off course and the way he's behaving now, and they just raise a whole lot of interesting questions for me as a writer to have been exploring. Yeah. You know, what's going on with T? You know, why was that image so interesting to him? Why was it a picture that he felt fascinated by? Why is he stopping for this young woman? And I think the story goes on to explore that question, and I think answer it by the end.
Yeah. Were you particularly somehow in some way interested in doing some thinking about men at middle age?
Absolutely. I think I was interested in thinking about desire, not just sexual desire, but emotional desire, and the way that drives people, both the consequences, both good and bad. There's that guitar that runs through this. The guitar that they're carrying, the red guitar, seems to me to suggest much of that thematically. The passion that pushes you can push you to do extraordinarily stupid and dangerous things, but it's also necessary to fully live your life. And so how do we deal with desire? We don't want to wipe it out of our life. You don't want a life without desire. But you have to learn how to behave responsibly, and you have to learn how to deal with desire in a way that's, well, moral is kind of an old-fashioned word, but that's one of the things I'm interested in, one of the things I'm interested in exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what's going on for me, in part, in the novel, is an exploration of desire. And then in a very particular way, it's a lot of the novel is about the desire of older men, but also women, for younger men and women. And this is just, I mean, I don't mean it as a sort of political statement only as another expression of desire and an attraction to beauty, an attraction to youth. And how does one behave in response to that attraction and to those, into such feelings? Mm-hmm. And I think the novel explores that. I mean, he himself has this problem in his past from this image, but also he's attracted to this younger woman. And then we learn also that when he was a very young man, he had a long and crucially important affair with a professor. So he's sort of on the other side of that too, as a young man being involved with an older woman. Mm-hmm. And he is an older man, is involved. He finds the situation exactly flipped. He finds himself back in the same part of the world, but instead of being a young man there having an affair with an older woman, he's an older man thinking about having an affair with a younger woman. So I think those questions sort of get echoed in the story.
Mm-hmm. Probably the character, it seems to me, the character that is the most fully developed is indeed this man that we're talking about. And that as you read, as you proceed in the story, you learn more and more about him as you go along. You do also learn about the other characters, although in a way that makes you, I think, question at every step, because you're learning about them because they are telling things, they are telling their story, the story of their lives, to the main character. And I think as a reader, given the situation, you have to ask yourself continually, now, is that true? Are they telling the truth? Are they telling some kind of story?
Right.
Is it some sort of combination of true thing and not? So it makes you, I think you want to, when he tells you something, or when you, the writer, tells the reader something about T, you say, okay, well, that ought to be pretty much the truth. With the other characters, you have to question everything that they say. So this is a long way of saying that all the way through, I think you're continually asking that question, what's going on, what's going to happen next, and is what this person is saying, is what I'm being told about this person actually what
right.
really happened?
Well, I mean, part of that is the way we would expect the situation to naturally unfold if you did indeed pick up two hitchhikers. Could you believe their stories? If you pick up a hitchhiker, do you believe the story that he or she is telling you? Or do you question that story? I think that's the way it would be actually in the real world in the midst of such an experience. We wouldn't know whether the story we were getting was the truth or not. And then on another level, I'm interested in how difficult it is to understand ourselves and others, to ever know really who other people are. There's the face that they present to us, and then there's the truth underneath. And often we don't know which is real. And on an even more interesting level, I think that's sometimes true about ourselves, and certainly about T as a character. Mm-hmm. I think T is really unclear about who he is and where he is in the world. He's kind of stuck when the novel begins. He's living alone, entirely alone, isolated from his family, isolated from the rest of his life. And I think he's lost and just has no idea who he is. And part of what's happening is he comes back to an understanding, a better understanding, I think, by the end of who he might be, at least. And we just don't know who these characters are, Jenny and Lester. We see only what's presented to us. And what's presented to us is obviously a kind of fabric of truth and lies, the surface that they want us to see. And because we're reading the story, it's the surface that they're presenting to T.
Right.
And we know that that's probably not all true. So we're asking ourselves as readers, are these characters dangerous? You know, are they thieves? Are they murderers? Are they actually the victims that they claim to be? What is the truth? And I think that's part of what makes it a novel that's suspenseful to the degree it's suspenseful.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you, going back to when you were talking about how you, in the process, you had this character and you were interested in developing him, and that the way that you work is often by taking characters and by putting them into a situation and then seeing what happens.
Right, exactly.
And whenever I hear a writer say that, I guess I always find myself thinking that is indeed the kind of things that writers say, and yet I think, now, wait a minute. You mean that you really don't have an idea where the story is going?
This has been one of the most interesting things I've learned in doing this book tour. Is I've done a lot of little bookstore signings where you meet with groups of 10 or 12 people. And when I tell them that I begin a story or a novel without having any idea where it's going, there's this sort of cynical, oh, yeah, oh, sure. I don't believe that, because it's hard to imagine that someone could actually write a whole novel without knowing where they're going. But I would argue, and I believe, that the writing is more likely to be exciting to the reader if it's exciting to the writer. In other words, if I don't know where a story is going, and I sit down at my desk excited about what the possibilities are, it's much more likely that that excitement is going to translate to the reader. Whereas me, as a writer, if I have an outline and I say, I'm going to make this happen and this happen, the writing tends to be dead. It feels like I'm pulling the reader along. If I'm manipulating the story so that event A is going to lead to event B is going to lead to event C, for me, the writing doesn't work as well on the page. But if I have a situation that has lots of potential avenues and I'm actually in the writing of it, excited about where the story might go, then the writing is more lively. And I love getting surprised in the process of writing. In Wolf Point, there are two or three times when things happen when I thought, oh my God, how am I going to continue writing this book after this happened? There's one particular moment later in the story when something happens between Lester and T, and I think, how can I do this? The novel's over now. But that was, in writing the story, the thing that had to happen. I just knew as a writer that this is what Lester would do at this moment. And so then I had to follow, well, what would happen next? What would T do? What are the possibilities? And it's like a series of fictional problems presenting themselves to you. The way I like to explain this is that when writing is really going well for me, it's similar to the reader's experience of being immersed in a good book. The reader can't wait to get back and open the book and get back into that world to see what's going to happen. When I'm really on a roll, I can't wait to get back to my desk to see what's going to happen. It's as if the novel or the story is already written, and all I have to do is get it down on the page. That's mm-hmm. when writing is really going well for me. And it was like that for all of Wolf Point.
Well, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Edward Falco. He's a professor of creative writing at Virginia Tech and has worked in different forms. He has written novels and short stories and poetry and also play. Couple of plays. His most recent novel, the one here we're talking about this morning, is Wolf Point, and it is published by Unbridled Books. And you can find it in a bookstore near you. He is here visiting the campus, spending a little time talking with students. His visit here sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the English Department. And we have a couple callers here. We have someone in Urbana to start us off. This is line number one.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Yeah, fine.
It's interesting because a couple of years ago I had a friend of mine who I do commercial advertising from my house and I write ad copy. And a friend of mine said, you write interesting stuff. Why don't you write books? I thought, I can't write a book. I've never even thought about it. So I started, as a sort of a whim, I started writing some of these ideas I had, and I'm listening to you, and it's astonishing how much what you're saying about your writing is how I have thought about what I write, and how I when I start writing something, I don't even really sort of know where I'm going, and the characters sort of like, I start to feel like I'm the character. I start, well, what would this person do? And then I go back and read, I've given some of the stuff that I've written to people, and they say, they'll say, well, I think this about this character, and I go, oh, I never even thought that. And it's just a fascinating thing to do because I've done studio work for years in painting and in watercolor and illustration and computer art, and I never quite thought of that medium as the way I think about writing. And I'm listening to you, and you were describing just a few minutes ago how you love to go to to your computer or whatever. I write on a computer, and I just love to get up and see where it's going to go.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head as you talk.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me how the process is somewhat similar with media like paint and oil.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stuff, slightly different, but it's amazing how you didn't know it was in you. That's
right.
Where does it come from? I mean, it's an amazing thing to do. I mean, it really is. I mean, I never thought of that part of the creative process. I mean, I've always read novels and mostly nonfiction, like through articles and books on politics and stuff like that. And I think it's quite a different medium. But, I I mean, just to listen to you say, I have to come over to the U of I and meet you. I mean, it's amazing to me that, I mean, you're saying what I think.
That's great.
Because I sit at the computer and I write, and I just love to write now.
I think what we're really describing is writing as an organic process.
Yeah.
Rather than as a rote process.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a couple short stories, and it's like, I just let it go, and I go back and edit later because computers make it very easy to edit. But I look at this stuff and think, well, you know, like I write some women characters, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not a woman. What do I know? But it's amazing how
they take on a life of their own.
Yeah, right? it's amazing. They're almost like, I know they're a part of me, but they're just, I don't know where these people, I mean, maybe they're just figments of my imagination. I don't know, but it's amazing. I just to listen to you. I really appreciate what you say. I mean,
thank you.
And I think it's hard for people to understand,
right?
Unless you tried to do it, I had no idea I could do this.
Well, I think what you're describing is the way in which the writing process can tap into the unconscious.
Oh yeah.
When you allow yourself to, Robert Olin Butler talks about writing as coming from a sort of dream space.
Yeah.
A place where you get into an imaginative, creative space that taps into the unconscious, and I think that things emerge. Interesting things emerge out of that space. And if you've planned out your writing, if you said, I'm going to write this and this is going to happen, it's harder to get into, for me at least, that kind of magical, dreamlike space out of which the most interesting writing comes.
I absolutely agree with that statement because, I mean, I wrote this one novel started out with one idea. It was about an 18th century mathematician whom I have I just enjoy reading about science in the 18th and 19th century because it's, you know, it's primitive and it sort of accelerates into this what's now modern science. And it just became this whole other thing about Islam. I don't know where it came from. And I thought to myself, well, where did all this come from? And it's just, it's an amazing process. And I really, really want to thank, I really am amazed. I had to call you and just tell you that I'm astonished that, I mean, it's almost as if like, you know, the Jung's universal consciousness is sort of like, I'm thinking this guy saying what I have thought. I mean, I don't talk to anybody about this because, I mean, you know, I mean, I've gone to, there's a writer's group here in town, and I've gone to talk to them, and I listen more than anything else because I'm very, I don't know, afraid to talk about writing. I don't know what it is, but I heard you, and I thought, God, this is amazing. I mean, this guy thinks exactly what I think. And I mean, I really want to thank you. I really appreciate your. I hope and the audience listens because.
Well, thank you.
It's really interesting. Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck with your writing.
Thank you
for the call.
Bye.
Well, let's continue. We have someone who clearly is listening on the internet because they're calling from Ithaca, New York. And this is line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hello. Yes. First, I'd like to thank David for his wonderful show. It's so entertaining, and also I learn a lot. And for Ed Falco, I've really enjoyed all of your work, Ed.
Thank you.
I have to say, Wolf Point is the one thing I think I haven't read. I think I've read everything else by you.
Wow.
And I'm really looking forward to reading Wolf Point. But I have a question, kind of a follow-up question on the way the conversation's going, about process. One of my favorite short stories of yours is Tulsa Snow from Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha. And when you were talking about the notion of identity and surface and facade in the novel, and it made me think of that story, which has these incredible characters, Jesse and the narrator, and the whole construction of identity being a theme, the inner identity of the narrator and the outer facade of Jesse, who's had all these plastic surgeries to transform herself, and then the snow coming down like the blank slate. So all of it seems so beautiful and rich and mysterious in that story and so beautifully made. So I'm just so interested about the process that you use to create this kind of a fiction, because it's beautifully made, and yet I can connect to what you're saying because it also has this quality of mystery, as it isn't formulaic in any way. And I think that's one of the things I've enjoyed most about your work is the mysteriousness that surprises me. So my question, I just wondered if your process is that you, as you've explained, you put people in a situation and the story takes off and has an organic form and has its own life and so on. But I wonder just if you could try to share with us something about other technical aspects having to do with character. Do you, when you create your characters, do you keep a notebook, for example, and take notes on people, or do you take notes on scenes in the airport, for example, in the short story Tulsa Snow? The airport scenes are so wonderful, and the motel, and you know, what sort of research and observation do you depend upon? And my second follow-up to that is, once you get your work going, how many drafts do you have to go through to get a novel such as Wolf's Point? So the first is really about just the nuts and bolts of, even though you've got this very intuitive process, if you have any notebook or if you try to have any techniques about holding on to what you're living and experiencing.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, before I answer your question, one of the pleasures for a writer who does literary fiction, which is pretty much how I think of myself, is to find that there are good readers out there. And thank you so much for being such a good reader.
My pleasure.
It's a real pleasure to hear you talk about the stories. As for characters, my characters, if you ask me any one of my stories, I can usually tell you where the character came from, because that's often the starting point. I will suddenly be fascinated with somebody or something, and that fascination will often lead to a story. In Tulsa Snow, it comes from a visit to Tulsa, and I was at a cafe very much like the one in the story with a couple of guys in cowboy hats playing poker. And there were some interesting people having coffee in that morning. And that scene is sort of one of the places where it started. And then I have this terrible habit myself of picking up other people's inflections and other people's speech patterns. Now, I've tried all my life not to do this, but I'm perpetually embarrassing myself. I'm from New Jersey, and when I first moved to the South, after I was there a month or so, I would find myself slowing down and picking up a Southern accent, and I'd be talking with people, and suddenly I'd be a Southerner, and you know, and it was just embarrassing. And I do that. I will pick up other people's, and I've incriminated myself. You know, many times I've said, you know, what is wrong with you? You must have no character to do this. And so those things sort of came together in the characters. And then, you know, Jessie, I was just she is a very interesting sort of combination of several people, including myself. And it's another thematic thing that's always been of interest to me, and kind of what we were talking about with Wolf Point, the difference between the surface you present to people and what's underneath the surface. And so her surface slowly comes apart in the story. She slowly comes back to...
She takes out her teeth.
Yes. You know, and I knew a poet from Syracuse, who I'm not going to mention, who used to talk about... her teeth were all twisted when she was before she had enough money to go ahead and have the surgery to change it and to have her teeth all straightened out. And she had this picture of an actual cast of her teeth and what they looked like, and she would show people that. So all those things sort of come together in the creation of those characters.
Do you keep a notebook that you can draw upon to remember, or do you just have a very good memory?
No, I don't do a notebook, but I'm very technological these days. I have a little very lightweight digital recorder that I carry around with me, and I often look strange as I pull it out of my pocket. And I try to pretend it's a phone sometimes, and just talk into it.
That's a real writer's secret there.
Well, when I get through writing in the morning, I take a walk on this little road. I live on a mountain road, and there are houses along the side, and I have this little digital recorder with me. And when I stop writing, usually I say, okay, I'm done for the day. And then as I'm walking, ideas sort of rise to the surface, and I pull this recorder out. And more than once, I've found myself walking past people's houses, and they've been standing in the driveway looking at me as I talk into this recorder. I didn't realize they were there. And so I'm in the midst of some other world, some other story, talking into this recorder, and they just think I'm crazy, obviously. I keep a digital recorder, and I will simply speak a few sentences into it and then transcribe it later.
I see. So it's used really like a notebook, but not used to actually have other people recording other people
right.
unawares. Right. I've always been tempted by that, actually.
Yeah. You know, every once in a while the recorder was sort of digressing here, but every once in a while the recorder will come on accidentally by itself. You know, it'll and I'll listen to a little audio segment of my life that I didn't know I was recording. And I find that fascinating.
When you write your novel, do you find because of this method of the story just taking off that you have to go through many drafts? Is a lot wasted, or is it very economical, or don't you even think in those terms? You're just so involved with the process. But I just wonder how amorphous it gets before you're able to make it into something that's so exquisitely formed as the fiction I've read by you.
Well, thank you. My process is to write a little bit every day. Half a page is okay. You know, two or three pages is great. And as long as I'm doing that every day, I try to do it in the morning, and so I develop this routine. I know I'm there. It's easier to get into that dream space we were talking about when it's happening as a matter of routine. You know, from 10 o'clock till noon, that's my writing time. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sort of used to getting into that dreamy, imaginative space there. Mm-hmm. But I'll write one or two pages a day and then sleep on it. And usually ideas for the story I'm working on will sort of emerge, come to the surface during the day, which is why I carry that little digital recorder around with me. I've learned that the best ideas come when I'm walking, taking a shower, and going to bed. Mm. And that those are really inconvenient times. And usually the ideas are good, so I know I can't just blow them off. I have to actually record them somehow. But then I'll go back and I'll write the next two pages, and it builds that way, you know, a couple of pages at a time. And if you write every day, you know, the work builds up. You can do a story in 2 or 3 weeks, a novel in, you know, a year or so, if you're writing every day.
That's a really good tip. Yeah. I should say, too, I really appreciate the way that your writing involves itself and engages with these dark areas of the human experience and things that are hard to confront, I think, and hard to think about maybe. And even strange sexualities in the motel scene in
Tulsa Snow.
And the way you write about sexuality is really great. There's a website, Worst Writing About Sex, and it has excerpts from literary writing that are just the worst attempts to to do it. And it's very hard to write about it well, but somehow you really managed to do that. And also other difficult areas, you know, kids who are taking drugs and kids who are having problems and all that sort of stuff that can be, it's very, very interesting, but I think hard to read, and if not done with such care and delicacy, and you really somehow know how to do that. So that's something I've really enjoyed in your work, and I just wanted to thank you for that.
No, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Okay. Thanks a lot. All right. Thank you.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Ed Falco. He makes his home in Blacksburg, Virginia, where he teaches writing and literature at Virginia Tech's MFA program. He has written novels, stories, poetry, plays, and there are quite a number of things of his in print. Let me just mention three titles because they were all recent, all published this year. Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha, New and Selected Stories, Wolf Point, the novel that we've been talking a bit about this morning, and also In the Park of Culture, a collection of short fictions. That one published by the University of Notre Dame Press, and the others from Unbridled Books. He's here visiting on the campus to talk with writers, would-be writers here. His visit sponsored by the MFA Creative Writing Program in the English department. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. For those people who are not with us from the very beginning, just I want to mention the basic story again. Wolf Point is three characters. Tom, the man who we meet, first character we meet, who picks up the two hitchhikers. And I was talking with someone else who had started reading the book and who'd made a comment about it I thought was kind of interesting. And her comment on it was that she found the characters very unlikable. And I started thinking about that, and we talked about that a little bit. And I was interested in one sense because my reaction to them, I'm not sure there was either liking or not liking. Although I think in some ways I found that maybe in some small way I could understand T. I kind of think I know what...
Brave of you to admit it.
Well, I'm sorry, but yes, I think I understand this man somewhat. But it started me thinking about, well, the reaction of the reader to the character and what it is that keeps us reading a story. where on one hand we might say, I don't care about this person. This is not worth my time. I'm going to go and do something else. And that doesn't necessarily, and it's not necessarily about liking or not liking, I think, as I'm sure that there are plenty of stories where you don't like the characters. You wouldn't want to meet them in real life, but you will continue reading the story because you want to find out what happens.
Well, you know, one of the nice things about that wonderful caller from just a moment ago, besides her being so intelligent in reading the fiction, was that she appreciated that the stories dealt with the darker sides of characters. And what I almost always hear is the opposite. You know, why aren't your characters, you know, better adjusted? You know, why aren't we looking at the brighter side of life? And I don't know how to answer that, except that my characters seem real to me. They seem like real people with in the act of writing. You know, I'm not pretending. I'm not putting forward a facade, as we always do in social life, as we always do with meeting people. We don't come to people and say, this is the real me. You know, we put up a kind of mask and say, this is who I'd like you to see me as. But when I'm writing, I'm pretending to be really inside. I'm imagining myself inside the person as the person really is. And that is not, you know, that's not just the mask. That's all the raw stuff. That's all of the chaos. That's all of the swirl of desires and emotion. And for me, my characters are real. They're not necessarily, you know, the dark side of things. Although I often in exploring their problems and exploring the issues that they're engaged with at the moment, I'm looking at their troubles and I'm looking at their conflicts. And so the stories often are dark in that sense, but for me they're just real. There are real emotional life. There are real life under the surface life that everybody sees. It's the life we all live, but we don't share with others because, you know, you don't do that. You don't go up to others and say, "This is the turmoil that I'm in at the moment." That you keep to yourself and to a few intimate others. But when I write, I try to look at that stuff, you know, rather than look at the manners, the surface of the character. Mm.
Just, you know, last week I had the chance to talk with Malter Mosley, and the mystery writer.
Right.
And one of the things that we talked a little bit about was this business of characters and what it is that makes characters in fiction seem real. And I came across a story that must have happened fairly early on where he had been doing a book signing somewhere. And someone came up to him, and this was – it may have been right back at the beginning when he had published Devil in a Blue Dress, the first novel about this character, E.Z. Rollins, that he created. And that somebody came up to him and said, "Mr. Mosley, I really want to read your next book because in this book – E.Z. Rollins did something that upset me so much, I want to read the next book because I want to try to figure out why he did that." And Mosley said he was really pleased by that reaction, the fact that the reader responded to the character so much as if this was a real character, and that something the character had done had upset him so much that he felt that he must get a better understanding of that character and figure out why. Right. That you would get that engaged with a fictional character, I think that's a tribute. That's a mark of achievement by the writer.
I think character is the heart of fiction. I mean, other people will tell you other things, but for me, character and the interesting character is what pulls me to writing. If I think back to the books I loved growing up, you know, the books that really captured me, it's some character in them that I really cared about. And the character doesn't even have to be human. In Call of the Wild, it was the dog that I was so interested in. But character's at the heart of things, and a good story is one that has a character you come to care about both emotionally and intellectually, and so you want to know who this character is and why the character behaves as the character does. And I think that's what keeps us reading in a story. In a novel we like, we're interested in the characters and their situations, and we want to understand them more deeply. And if we understand them more deeply, often there's an element of universality at work so that we come to understand ourselves more deeply.
What are the differences between the way that you approach a story and the two different forms, the story form, the novel form, the difference between the shorter and the longer?
Yeah, well, I'm tempted to just say length is the difference. the novel has defeated me for many years because it's a wider, sort of more encompassing form, and my imagination is tighter. I like everything. It's more compulsive. I like everything to work together, and I like everything to work harmoniously. And the novel is a more sprawling kind of form. So I've often foundered trying to write novels. On a craft level, a practical answer for me is that a short story usually has one character and one central event, so that you can develop that in 5,000 to 8,000 words. You can get the character going, and you can get the situation adequately described in the space of 5,000 to 8,000 words. When you start adding more characters who are important to the story, it's going to get longer and longer. So this novel has three characters whom I care about and who, as a writer, I need to develop. And so it turned into, I knew when I had three characters, all of whom had to be developed, that it was not going to be a short story anymore. I didn't know whether it was going to be a novella or a novel, but I followed it to where it went, and it turned out to be novel length.
Yeah. And yet, this is certainly not intended to be a criticism. I'm not sure that all three characters really are equally developed.
No.
And so I guess that I wonder about, well, how you think about that. Was it not that necessary to develop all three completely? Because, and to the extent that you did develop Tom's character completely, that is, he was the important thing. That was the thing
that
you were thinking about. He's the point of view character, and that the others are very necessary to the story, but are supporting players in a sense.
Right. Well, it's kind of a complicated question. Tom is the central character. He's the character whose development we're following. Mm. But the characters he's interacting with, Jenny and Lester, are crucial to his story. To understand him, we have to understand them at least to a degree. We have to sort of come to our own sort of notion of who Jenny is and why she's behaving the way she is, and Lester also. So each of them are developed, but through Tom's perspective. So we can't know, because we're never inside Jenny's head and we're never inside Lester's head. We're always getting how Tom sees them. Hmm. And I think because of that, you can't develop them the way you can. I couldn't develop them the way I can develop Tom as a character. I mean, I think by the end of the novel, I feel like I know both of those characters pretty well through Tom's perspective. But certainly they're not as developed as characters as Tom, because I'm never inside their mind. I'm never privy to their thoughts. I'm only privy to Tom's thoughts in his point of view. It's a third person limited perspective in the novel.
Is Wolf Point a real place?
Actually, there's a real place in the Thousand Islands called De Wolf Point, and my working title for this novel was Red Guitar. And I wrote the novel with the title Red Guitar. And then my publishers felt that the red guitar in the novel was already a little too heavily symbolic, and if I called it Red Guitar, it would sort of point, with a magnifying glass. This is what the red guitar is, a symbol. And I think they had a good point. And so by calling it Wolf Point, I moved away. I didn't have that problem. Yeah. My agent hates the title. He thinks it sounds like the latest Ed McBain thriller. Others have told me they really like the title, and I've come to live with it as a decent title for the book.
Yeah. Well, I was to try to get in my mind set some things. I actually took out my atlas and I was looking at upstate New York and realized, no, yes, there actually is a place called Thousand Islands, and it is on the St. Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And started me thinking, well, to what degree this was actually a real place, and have you actually stood in this place, and were you thinking, no, this is pretty interesting. What might I do with
real
this?
I used to vacation there at De Wolf Point in the Thousand Islands. Is the place a little island, a little peninsula of land that juts out into the Thousand Islands where I used to take vacations. It's a stunningly gorgeous part of the world. I love it there. It is right across the border from Canada. You can get in a little rowboat and actually row across to the Canadian side. It's a very beautiful, very isolated part of the world. That's all real.
Yeah. The story, there's a lot of story here. And one of the things that I think is striking about it is the economy with which it's told, because it's not a long book.
No.
And yet you managed to convey a lot about these characters and things. A lot happens in a very short space of time. I guess I'm interested in whether the idea of economy in writing is something that's important to you.
Yes.
He says very economically.
I'm not quite sure how to answer that, except that I'm not Faulknerian where I'm interested in sort of long. Although I love William Faulkner, I'm more toward the Raymond Carver, Hemingway, short, precise, accurate descriptions, language as a descriptive medium. I'm not really making a lot of sense here, except I think short answer, yeah, precision and economy matter to me, yes.
Well, that's what a different way of asking the question or a better way of asking it is that something that is just a natural part of the way that you work and you write, or whether that's something that you should actually have to work at. And perhaps in the process of revising how much writing and rewriting you do, whether in fact you work. And I think that there are some writers who, in a very deliberate way, as they go along through drafts, they pare stuff away. They're trying to say, looking at something that they've written and ask this question, what is the most essential stuff here? And they have a way of taking other things that might be nice but not essential to telling the story, and they say, okay, we'll get rid of that.
Right, yeah. I think style is something that one usually learns as a writer. One feels themselves attracted to a kind of writing. And so that element of style is simply one I'm attracted to, precision and economy and saying things as precisely as one can and cutting extraneous material. And part of it is that I read a whole lot of poetry. You know, I think you have one of my favorite poets here last week, Alice Fulton, on your show. But I read a lot of poets and a lot of poetry, and of course, that's at the heart of poetry: the mm-hmm. precision and economy of language and imagery. The imagery is a good way of thinking about it, since the image can convey so much. You learn in reading poetry that an image can contain so much complex information that I think that's what I'm sort of shooting for in writing, too, to find the image, to find the scene that conveys a whole lot rather than talking about it. This is an element of taste also. Some people like writing that's talky, and that tells you what the character is feeling and what the character is thinking and tells you what things mean. I tend much more toward the imagistic, to letting the image do the speaking.
Mm-hmm. We're almost at the point where we're out of time, and I hesitate to get into a different area, but I'm interested in the hypertext poetry that you've done. I guess particularly I'm interested in the question of whether you had ever experimented with or thought about doing hypertext fiction.
I have a hypertext novel called A Dream with Demons.
Oh, I see. Well, I didn't realize that I should have been more careful in looking at your work. I didn't realize that actually you had to, because I know you had done the other.
You're not one of the three people who's read A Dream with Demons.
Oh, surely there have been tens of readers, no doubt.
20s maybe. Yes. No. Hypertext is an experimental kind of writing that's in its purpose is to see what can be done on the computer screen. So it's nonlinear, and I think hypertext writers are interested in writing that works by linking words and images and sounds and anything that you can find on a computer, and seeing how you can tell a story that way. One loses control in the writing of hypertext. You can't. you can't make a story the way you can on the page with one event leading to the next, one moment leading to the next moment, because the reader is clicking on words and clicking on images and popping around and navigating the story by their own series of choices, the choices that they make. So you can't structure a hypertext in traditional ways, and that's part of the challenge. My hypertext novel has a traditional novel on one level. You can read from beginning to the end. And then underneath it is the purported notes of the writer in the process of writing it. So you can go back and listen to him talking about in his notes what he was thinking about when he was writing the novel. And one comments on the other. The novel comments on the writer's notes. The writer's notes comments on the novel.
Well, there I think we have to leave it with, again, the recommendation for people who are listening to take a look at some of the work by our guest, Ed Falco. The novel, the one that we have talked about this morning, is Wolf Point, and it's just come out this year. Unbridled Books is the publisher. Also, among his recent work, a collection of stories, Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha, and In the Park of Culture, a collection of short fiction. That one's published by University of Notre Dame Press, just came out this year. And then Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha and Wolf Point, they're both published by Unbridled Books. And there are others, so you can head out to the library or the bookstore and look for the books. Our guest, Ed Falco, teaches writing and literature at Virginia Tech's MFA program. He edits The New River, an online journal of digital writing. Makes his home in Blacksburg, Virginia. He's here visiting. Here is visit sponsored by the MFA Creative Writing Program in the English Department here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
The broadcast today is made possible by the U of I Center for Advanced Study. The inaugural Chancellor's CAS Special Lecture presents Overachievers, What Honeybees Teach Us About Genes, Brain, and Social Behavior by Gene Robinson on Wednesday, November 2nd. Well, I guess that's happened already. Well, it happened at 7:30 in the auditorium in the Beckman Institute. A lot of other interesting things going on at the Center for Advanced Study. You can go to their website, www.cas.uiuc.edu, and look for information on upcoming programs and activities. The broadcast today also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925, Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We're going to take a break as we usually do. We'll have an update on the markets, we'll have news, and then more focus, so stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave.